Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for joining us as we begin the show by talking about your skin care with our guest, Dr. Apple Bodemer. She is a dermatologist, professor in the Department of Dermatology at UW-Madison and comes by every so often to talk with us. So as we visit with Dr. Bodemer today, I hope you'll join in. Do you suffer from adult acne? What treatments have made it better? Let's take a look at sunscreen. How often have you been applying sunscreen this summer? What questions do you have about skin cancer? Join the conversation. Number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Dr. Apple Bodemer, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be here, Larry.
Let's talk about acne to begin, adult acne. Most people probably know what it looks like, acne, but describe what's happening to your skin when you develop a pimple.
Well, there's a couple of key steps that happen in the development of a pimple or blemish. And one of the things that happens with acne is we get what we call excess skin cells will build up inside the hair follicles, causing a blockage of that pore. We call that hyperproliferation, or that buildup of skin cells. When that happens, oil will get blocked. So instead of going, like, just flowing out of the hair follicle to cover the skin, it can build up inside that hair follicle. Additionally, there are hormonal drivers that trigger the oil glands to go into overdrive and make more oil. And so the combination of that really sets you up for getting this blocked, plugged pore. And that causes bacteria that are normally present on the skin to kind of throw a party. There's a lot more food for them to eat. They start inviting all their friends and start making more bacteria, and that causes a lot of inflammation. So it's kind of just a big mess that starts to happen underneath the skin that leads to inflammation, and it's kind of all of it together. When we have a whitehead or blackhead, that's just kind of the plugging happening. But with the inflammation, if that hair follicle bursts underneath the skin, that can create even more inflammation and can lead to these painful, what we call nodulocystic lesions or big nodules.
Hard, painful cysts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are there different types of acne? I imagine there are.
Yes. I mean, we have kind of the more standard acne. And so acne can be broken down into the types of acne lesions we have. So there's comedones, which are whiteheads and blackheads. And a blackhead is really just an open comedone, meaning that the oil, instead of having a little covering of skin over it, keeping it white, it gets oxidized when it gets exposed to air. So a lot of people see the blackheads and think that that's dirt building up inside the hair follicles. And that's not. That's actually your natural oils oxidating when they get into contact with air. And then there's the papules and pustules, or inflammatory acne, and then the nodulocystic, and then the scarring acne. So all of, you know, we can kind of differentiate it based on the types of acne lesions a person has, and many people have a combination of them. We also see standard kind of teenage acne, which we sort of expect to see in most teens, at least in our culture. And then there's another bump in acne that we tend to see more in middle age or even later adulthood that tends to have a stronger hormonal drive to it.
So I'm wondering how our hormones relate to acne then? I mean, I remember back when I was a teenager, it was a painful year or two for me.
Yeah.
For sure. Was it raging hormones?
Well, I mean, naturally during puberty, hormones rise up. And we see that the androgens in particular, the male type hormones, and females have androgens as well, but they tend to drive the hair follicle to cause this hyperproliferation, or the skin cells to build up inside the hair follicle, and also the oil glands to produce more oil. And so we'll see that peak, but it's a real complicated picture because it's not just the levels of hormones. If it were just that, we would expect all guys to get acne, and as, you know, women, we shouldn't. But there are other hormones that play a big role, too, and it's the relative amounts of hormones. So when estrogen levels start to fall, which we can see after menopause, or we can see in certain conditions that we consider hyperandrogenetic, or things like metabolic syndrome. We see this in diabetes, and we see it in polycystic ovary syndrome, where androgen levels get really out of balance when it compared to estrogen levels. And so that falling estrogen or lower estrogen related to androgen can drive acne as well. But there are some other hormones as well, including insulin, like growth factor. That's one that can really drive androgen production, or those male type hormone productions, and also can directly impact the hair follicle.
I'm wondering about cosmetics and maybe hair products. Can they cause acne, if I'm not mistaken, or am I?
Yeah, no, if there is a lot of things that are really blocking the pores, so heavy use of very thick cosmetics can cause the hair follicles to get blocked. And, you know, this was a popular thing on social media. I was seeing a lot of people talking about slugging, or thick layers of Vaseline on the skin, which is really, really great for somebody who has really dry skin and is not prone to blemishes, but can really wreak havoc on acne by causing more blockage of the pores. We also see physical acne, where there's chronic rubbing or compression of the skin. In athletes in particular, we'll see that with football players or lacrosse players, athletes that wear helmets, that can really aggravate acne. Chlorine can also aggravate acne, so we can see that in swimmers sometimes, where the chlorine really dries the skin out and causes the oil glands to kind of go into overdrive trying to protect the skin.
You have, I'm sure, some ideas about lotions and creams that don't clog pores. There must be some out there.
Yes, and most things will be labeled as anti-comedogenic. So if you have problems with acne and you're looking for makeups, cover-ups, things like that, you'll want to look for that. One of the other things, too, goes with the amount that you're putting on, because for some people, a very thin layer, even of something as thick as Vaseline, can be helpful. I recommend a lot of plant-based oils. I think they can be wonderful. They're full of antioxidants and have some anti-inflammatory properties. But I remind my patients, it's 2 or 3 drops to moisturize your face. We shouldn't be splashing handfuls of oil on our face, because it has to do with the amount that can...
Yeah, I can see that happening. There's an idea that if you eat too much chocolate, you're going to break out.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an accurate claim?
Yes. Unfortunately, it does appear that some people are chocolate sensitive. So this isn't everybody, but there have been some studies. And when I first was reading about this, I thought, well, that's the milk chocolate. That's the, you know, kind of the Hershey's lower quality chocolate. But it does appear that even high quality dark chocolate can cause some people to break out. One of the other things that goes along with this is most of us, when we're eating chocolate, it might come in the form of a candy bar or have other added sugars. Any foods that are really high in simple sugars, meaning not associated with fiber or that are highly processed, can really drive acne through insulin and insulin-like growth factor pathways.
A listener emailed us. They're in their late 20s, have pillar cysts on their scalp that they inherited, I think, from their mom's side, and we can talk about genetics too. But at the moment, they probably have 12 or so of these cysts on their scalp, and they've had them since they were a tween, and some are quite large. Never had them removed, but they've been thinking of making a dermatological appointment. Is removal worth it? Anything she can do to reduce them or keep them from coming back?
Yeah, not really. So pilar cysts are little cysts that grow on the scalp, and they can be quite large. They can be painful. They usually are movable. So if you kind of put your finger on it, you usually can move them around a little bit. And genetics definitely play a role with these types of cysts. They're not related to acne. It's kind of luck of the draw. If you're prone to them, you're prone to them. And in terms of getting them removed, the way that we remove them is we cut into the scalp. Of course, we numb the area up first, but it is a small surgical procedure to remove those cysts. If the cyst comes out all in one piece, which they often do, but not always, then they're not likely to come back. But you, if especially if she's got that many, it's likely that she could get new ones. I would say get them removed if they bother you. If they're not bothering you, there's no reason they need to be removed.
Makes good sense. Well, let's say you wake up in the morning and notice you have a pimple on your face. What should you do in order to heal that spot as quickly as possible?
Well, the number one thing not to do is pick at it. And that's really hard to avoid that temptation for most of us. But any picking, scratching, or aggressive rubbing that you do is going to increase your risk for scarring. Acne typically will go away on its own without scarring when it's in kind of the mild to mild moderate category. There are some people who have very severe nodulocystic acne, and scarring can be very significant for them, even if they're keeping their hands off of it. But that's the first thing is treat it gently. There are over-the-counter washes and spot treatments that you can use. Benzoyl peroxide and salicylic acid are two that are really readily available and easy to find. These new colloid dressings, or their little acne pimple stickers, they can work really well for a couple of different reasons, because there's a little, it just kind of provides a nice environment for the skin to heal, and it also helps us keep our fingers off of them.
Yeah. Is it ever a good idea to squeeze a pimple?
No. No, you know, because if we think about it, it's kind of like imagining a little balloon underneath the skin. So if you have a white head or a black head and we start squeezing two sides of it, then if you imagine what a balloon would do in that situation, it's going to pop out the other two sides. And that can cause kind of these mini explosions underneath the skin, which draws inflammation and irritation and kind of keeps the whole cycle going a lot more robustly than we would like. If you do feel the need to what we call express them, there are little tools that you can get that are metal and they have a tiny hole in the center. They're called comedone extractors, and you can find them at Walmart or Target or online. And you can apply those. The difference with that is it's applying an even pressure around the perimeter or around the edges of that acne lesion. And if it's ready to clear itself out, then it will. Sometimes you might apply one of these comedone extractors and it might not pop. And in that case, you might want to use a warm compress. So just a little bit of a warm wet washcloth and hold it on the area for 2 to 5 minutes. And then you could try again if you're really determined to get rid of that whitehead.
Yeah. And if it gets infected, what do you do? Anything?
Well, most of the time it's inflammation. Occasionally acne can get infected. Usually that's associated with a lot of picking. And that is something that if that's commonly happening, then you should seek out the help of a physician.
Our guest today, Dr. Apple Bodemer, a dermatologist and professor in the Department of Dermatology at the UW-Madison. Great to have her back with us. And if you have questions, we're talking acne now, but I also want to get into sunscreens and perhaps skin cancer with her. You can join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about skin care and your skin health with our guest, Dr. Apple Bodemer, dermatologist and professor in the Department of Dermatology at UW-Madison. Dealing with acne right now, but we're also want to get into sunscreens and sunburn and that sort of thing as well. And again, join in 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Cameo in Oshkosh will give you a chance to join in. Thank you for calling.
Hi.
Hi, great to have you along.
Yeah, good to be here.
And you have a question.
Yes, I do. So I had surgery when I was younger, like 15 years ago. So I had, I have scar tissue behind my ears. And like, it was, you know, 15 years ago, the scars are fully healed. But I do tend to get acne right on the edge of those scars. And I was just wondering, like, if there's a reason for that or if there's a way to stop that from happening, because it is quite painful.
Hmm.
Yeah, one thing that can happen with scars is we can get cysts. And Well, acne is a type of cyst. We call, you know, there are some cystic appearances to acne. Epidermal inclusion cysts or milia are two other types of cysts that are common in scar tissue. So that would be important to distinguish exactly what's going on, especially if it's within the scar tissue or right along the edge of it. Those types of, with the inclusion cysts, they need to be removed surgically. So sometimes they can be, you know, drained, or if you are able to express the material, they just come right back in the same spot. So if that's happening, then it's not actually acne, but it's more in this cyst category. And if they are painful, it might be worth checking in with a physician to see about having them removed.
Yeah, that makes sense. Somebody else wondered about washing your face. How often should you wash your face to treat or prevent acne?
Once or twice a day is really all you need. I think you can do a lot more damage by over-cleansing, especially if you're using harsh chemicals to cleanse with. A lot of people have the idea that acne comes from dirty skin, and that's not the case. If we over-dry the skin using harsh soaps, that actually triggers the oil glands to do what they're supposed to do, which is to protect the skin. And so we want to be careful that the cleansers that we use should be gentle cleansers, not harsh antibacterial soaps, especially on the face, especially if you're prone to acne.
And when is it time to see a dermatologist about your acne?
If your acne is leading to scarring or it's interfering with your life, then those would be two reasons to check in. And if it's mild, you could even check in with your primary care doctor who might be able to give you a few tips, and that might be all it takes. If it's more significant or severe, then checking in with a dermatologist would make sense.
Pam in Wausau has a different sort of question, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Pam.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I had a Mohs surgery done on my nose for skin cancer. And what I want to know is, how do you know afterwards whether you should go back in or whether it's healing properly?
Yeah, so the Mohs procedure, so typically it depends a little bit on where you are after the procedure. It takes a year for a scar to settle down. And if you have concerns about the wound, if there's drainage or pain or redness that is not symmetric, so there's going to be some redness and discomfort during the healing process, but that should be in the kind of immediate healing process. Those would be things that you could check in with your surgeon's office about. A lot of times nursing staff can take care of questions if you have concerns. Typically, once the area has healed, it's a good idea to get a skin check about 6 months after the procedure and see where things are at with the rest of your skin. The highest risk for developing a second skin cancer is within those first couple years. And so having your skin looked at and then paying attention to your own skin. So skin self-checks are really the most powerful tool you have to detecting something early and getting it caught early.
Pam, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Jeff wonders, would you recommend men not shave their face if they have acne?
Well, if you are struggling with acne or folliculitis, which is a little bit different than acne but similar, then shaving can often make it worse, or it can be painful. So that would be a personal call. There are certainly things that you can do if your acne is mild, and especially if it shows up right after shaving. Shaving can cause a lot of irritation to the skin. So using a light moisturizer or a few drops of a plant-based oil to kind of moisturize the skin and keep it supple can go a long way to helping offset the irritation and the irritant folliculitis that can happen from shaving.
I've heard that sleeping with a silk pillowcase might be gentler on your skin and reduce acne. How much can your pillowcase influence your skin's health?
Well, most of us, as long as you're keeping your pillowcase clean, I know that that's been a big thing, and my kids all came home saying that they needed a silk pillowcase. I think there hasn't been any real clear data on that, is what I would say. If you like your silk pillowcase, then it is still important to wash it frequently. And because silk takes a little bit more care, I think it can be tempting sometimes to maybe not wash it as frequently as you'd need to. But it should be getting washed about once a week at least, and that you still go through regular pillowcase care. But a lot of the cotton pillowcases are really soft and gentle on the skin as well.
Bill in La Crescent, Minnesota, we'll go to you now. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Question about my scalp. I have some little outbreaks. I guess you can call them pimple-like things. Mm-hmm. Four or five of them. They eventually form a little scab. What are those? What do I do about those?
Yeah, it sounds like it could be in that folliculitis category, which is irritation of the hair follicles. There's bacteria all over our skin, and it sounds like if they're getting kind of crusted and scabbed, you might be having a little bit of bacteria show up. That will do that anytime the skin gets broken down. I would start with a salicylic acid-based shampoo, which you'll find in the anti-dandruff section. So that's something that might be helpful. If that's not enough, you might want to see your doctor. Sometimes a topical antibiotic can be helpful to just dab on these areas as spot treatment, depending on if it looks like it's in that kind of folliculitis category.
Makes sense.
But that's where I start.
And while we're talking about shampoos, I just read somewhere where whoever wrote the piece said you shouldn't use shampoo every day. It could harm your scalp if you used it every day. Is that true?
I think it really depends. That's kind of an individual call, because especially for teens who tend to make a lot of oil, they sometimes need to wash every day just to keep their hair from getting too greasy, especially if they're athletes and they're having a lot of friction from helmets or things like that. As we get older, our oil glands do tend to settle down overall. And so by the time we get, to middle or later life, we probably don't need to be washing our hair every day. It also depends on how harsh the shampoos that you're using are. And some people that have dandruff, if their dandruff is really bad, they might need a harsh medicated shampoo every day to try to keep their scalp condition settled down. And as they start to get improvement, they can back off to using those medicated shampoos once or twice a week to hold things at bay. So I think it really is individual. And for the most part, most of the shampoos that you can get over the counter are not going to do a whole lot of damage. And for most people who have relatively healthy scalps, it's more a preference issue.
Frank in northern Wisconsin has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Frank.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
My wife has a history of breast cancer a couple years ago, and one of the doctors suggested that she is prone to skin cancer because of that history, and I wondered what your guest had to think about that.
Well, there are some mutations, so that would be something somebody would know if they had some genetic testing. That can be associated with melanoma. Most people with breast cancer don't get melanoma and don't necessarily have a higher risk of melanoma. But for families where we see things kind of run alongside each other, with a pancreatic cancer is another one that we can see associated with melanoma. I think for all of us, it's important to just check our skin and be comfortable with the kinds of spots our body makes, and to be aware of if something starts changing or you develop a new spot. Skin cancer is a broad category, and there's a whole lot of other skin cancers, basal cell and squamous cell, which are by far and away the most common types of skin cancer. And there really isn't any association of those specifically with breast cancer. That really has more to do with how much UV radiation exposure you have over the course of your lifetime and your skin type, how fair your skin is.
There you go, Frank. Thank you for calling. Mark in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I have a couple sunscreen-related questions. Mm-hmm. So one is they tend to be effective but impossible to wash off, even showering, rubbing with soap. We tend to use the mineral versions, and if you look in the ingredients, they virtually all have beeswax or some kind of wax. And I'm wondering, is there a brand that does not have that, or is there a way to remove it. The other quick question is, when will we see some of the superior sunscreen compounds that are approved in Europe but not in the U.S.? Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. The second question, I don't know when that's going to happen. I know that the FDA is getting a lot more pressure, especially in the last few years, as more and more reports have come out about some of the concerns with the chemicals that are commonly used in the chemical-based sunscreens here in the U.S. Hopefully sooner rather than later. Related to those mineral-based sunscreens that you're having a hard time washing off, there are a lot out there that are lighter in formulation, and the Environmental Working Group is a really great resource for finding those. I know some of the best ones, like Badger is a common one that's found, and that's a really, really thick, heavy one that I know I have a hard time getting that off of my skin, too. Just continuing to use soap and lather it up, eventually it will come off. But there are a lot of brands out there that are not quite so heavy that are mineral-based as well. So I'd encourage you to kind of look at the Environmental Working Group website. They put out a sunscreen guide every May and will rate many of the products that are on the market. It's a huge market. If you go to any Walgreens or Walmart or even grocery store, you'll see just so many things to choose from. So the Environmental Working Group can help kind of narrow things down. The other great thing that we have, at least here in Madison, is we have a couple of really great resources. And like places like the Willie Street Co-op really vet the products that they put on their shelf. And so if you know that if you find it at some place like that, and many other natural food stores do the same thing, and you could talk to the supplier of your pharmacy or natural food store to see how they decide what skin products to put on their shelves. And then that can give you some sense of confidence, knowing that, well, if you get it from a place that they've already done some of the legwork, then you can feel comfortable that whatever they're selling will be high quality. But it is, there's a lot of personal preference. What's too thick for me might not be too thick for somebody else, and vice versa. So there is a little bit of trial and error, but there's lots and lots of them in the market that aren't quite so heavy. So
there you go, Mark. Thank you for calling. A listener had emailed kind of in this area. They wear a foundation that has SPF in it. They're wondering how effective that is, or should they use an actual sunscreen instead of relying on their foundation? Their foundation is SPF 18.
Okay. So in general, when I'm looking for UV protection, we want an SPF of 30 or more. So if you're using a foundation that has an SPF of 18, that's not going to give you a whole lot of coverage, and you'll want to use an additional sunscreen on that. I also want to stress that sunscreen, I view really as a backup plan, that there are other protective behaviors that we can do that will decrease our risk of UV radiation exposure and decreases thus skin cancer risk and also the how quickly we age. And those include wide-rimmed hats, so a rim of at least 3, ideally up to 4 inches. Sunglasses with a wide lens will help protect the delicate skin around the eyes. Looking for shade when you can, trying to keep activities to the earlier morning and later afternoon and avoiding that in more intense midday sun. And then UV protective clothing. And they even have gaiters that you can pull up over your face, or if you're working outside, you can pull them up over your head and protect the neck, that are fairly lightweight and relatively cool, that if you're working outside in a garden or if you happen to be working outside in landscaping or construction, those kinds of things can really go a long way so that, you know, sunscreen is, we use it when we need it, but it doesn't have to be our primary defense.
Wondering about application now. I play golf, and when I walk 18 holes, typically I'll put some sunscreen on when I start, and then when I'm at the turn, after I've finished 9 holes, that's about 2 hours or so, mm-hmm. I'll put another application, usually while we're waiting for the people ahead of us to hit, mm-hmm. and then go for that application through to the end. Is that a reasonable thing to do?
Yeah, in general, if you have an SPF of 30 or more, and I, like I mentioned earlier, 30 is my kind of baseline for the low number, It needs to be reapplied at least every 2 hours. So you're probably doing okay. Unless you're sweating a lot and wiping the sweat off with a towel, your sunscreen is probably going right onto that towel. So that's one thing to be just paying attention to. If it's a cool day and you're not sweating very much, that's probably just fine. But if you're sweating a lot, you might need more frequent application.
Let's take a call from Mike in Plainfield. Mike, thank you for calling.
Yeah, I was diagnosed with a yeast infection in the groin and genital area about a week ago. And I was prescribed two creams. One is, I might kind of murder this pronunciation here, clotrimazole.
Uh-huh.
And the other one is triamcinolone.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering, I'm supposed to apply that twice a day, which I normally been doing now morning and night. I normally shower at night and then put it on afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
But in the morning, should I be showering, getting totally clean first, and then applying it then too? I mean...
Yeah.
Yeah, no, you don't need to. If you're putting on at night, and it would be soaked in by the time, you don't need to wash the skin again in order to reapply it. So I would just be a little careful about that triamcinolone in terms of how long you're using it in the groin, because that is a steroid, and if they're used for too long, steroids can thin the skin out, and that's fairly delicate skin to begin with. So a lot of times, if we're going to use a steroid, we might use it just in the initial stages to help with some of the inflammation and discomfort, but then once, a short ways into the treatment, we might want to switch away and just use that anti-yeast medication.
Yeah, so a short ways, like a week or two, or?
I probably would aim more for a couple of days.
Oh.
And it just depends on how severe the inflammation is. So I haven't seen you, and I don't know how inflamed it was, but we might want to use it a little longer if there's a lot of inflammation.
Mike, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Julie in Little Suamico emailed us, what's the best way to treat the hives Julie gets every time she gets sick? Typically develop about 4 days after the onset of something like a cold or a respiratory illness. They're extensive with large areas of raised red and extremely itchy skin. Typically lasts more than a week.
Well, if this is something that's happening every time you get sick, it might be a good idea to seek medical help because there are things that you can do. Over-the-counter antihistamines would be the first place to start. But if the individual spots are moving around during that week, that you kind of get a really itchy raised spot that shows up and then it disappears within 24 hours and then you get them in other places, that is what true hives look like. But if you're getting spots that are raised and itchy and sticking around for longer, it might be a good idea to just have a medical professional look at it. And, a biopsy might be helpful just to make sure that there's not anything else going on.
All right. And again, you can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. Talking today with Dr. Apple Bodimer, dermatologist, professor in the Department of Dermatology at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Apple Bodimer, dermatologist and professor in the Department of Dermatology at UW-Madison. Questions about your skin, maybe an experience? I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Let's go to Diane in Verona. Diane, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, I'm just finishing up an IV antibiotic therapy for Lyme disease, and so now I'm very tick conscious. I'm putting on off when I go outside to garden, and I'm just wondering, between sunscreen and the tick repellent, is there any protocol for which to apply first, or are they going to cancel out each other, or what does she know about that?
Well, it depends on how, like a lot of the insect repellents can be used on clothes. And so I don't know that there's a specific one right way to apply one versus first and then the other next. I would be inclined to put the sunscreen on because that typically is more of a cream base Most of the bug repellents that I'm familiar with are spray and more of a liquid that you kind of spray on either the skin or your clothes. So I think that would be my recommendation. If you are out gardening a lot, I'd really strongly recommend that you consider some of the UPF rated clothing. They have many different brands at many different price points. You'd want to look for a UPF of 50, which tells us that only 1/50th or only 2% of the UV radiation that hits the surface of the fabric will get through to your skin. And that holds up even when it does get wet or you get sweaty. So, and they do come very lightweight with ventilation and things like that too. So for people that are active outside or spend a lot of time outside in the middle of the day, like a gardener might, but I would, and that also will help you because that protective layer, the ticks aren't going to climb on your skin quite as readily, and it gives you an extra barrier.
Diane, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Gina emailed us, what treatments are available for removing brown spots on the face? Are laser treatments a good option? And if so, what type would Gina look for?
Well, that's a really tricky question because there's a lot of different kinds of brown spots that can show up on the face, especially as we get older. Sun damage can cause hyperpigmentation in a couple of different ways, and it would be really important to identify specifically what type of pigment you're dealing with first before you'd be able to determine whether a laser will be useful or not, or specifically which type of laser. It also matters what your baseline pigmentation is in the skin, because if you do have a little more pigment, or if you have higher pigment in your baseline skin, then you have to be a little bit more cautious with lasers. So I would say it'd be a good idea to get a sense for what the pigment is that you're trying to deal with and then go from there.
So see a dermatologist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And sometimes primary care doctors, you know, they could tell you, well, is this a seborrheic keratosis, which tend to be a little bit more raised, but they can be flat as well, and those don't respond very well to lasers or light treatments or to creams.
Okay, makes sense. So often we get burned, even if we think we're being careful about sunscreen. Well, first, what are some common mistakes when people make when it comes to sunscreen, and then what if you do get burned?
Yeah, so the common mistakes are not applying often enough. As we talked about earlier, it should be reapplied at least every 2 hours or after getting wet. So if you put a sunscreen on and go swim in the pool for 30 minutes, get out, towel off, all your sunscreen is on your towel, you would definitely need to reapply it before you go sit in the sun again. The other big common mistake is not putting enough on. So one rule of thumb is a palm full for a body in a bathing suit. So kids are going to have smaller palms. They also have smaller bodies. And that's a heaping palm full. That's not just a little smear on the bottom of your palm, but a good handful, basically. And most of us are not putting that much on, but that's what they use in the laboratory environments where they determine SPF levels. So that's an important thing to consider. Make sure you're using enough. If you have a 6-ounce bottle, that shouldn't last you all summer. If you're spending a whole day at the beach, that might last you one day if you're applying it appropriately, which is, again, where those protective clothing comes in, because if it's covering your skin, you're protected, and when it's off of your skin, you know you're not protected anymore. And I think that gives you a little bit more of a reliable base than, you know, is some of it wiped off or has it worn off, or, you know, that sort of thing that we end up with sunscreen.
You know, we've talked about SPF. I think we mentioned UVA. I'm wondering about the difference among SPF, UVA protection, and UVB protection.
Yeah. The SPF really is a measure of how quickly you'll turn red in the sun. And that is a measure of the UVB protective qualities of that sunscreen. We don't have a really great way to measure how effective a sunscreen is at blocking the UVA rays. And the UVA rays can actually penetrate deeper into the skin. They tend not to cause quite as much burning, but they definitely can cause DNA damage, and leading to accelerated aging and to increased risk of skin cancer. It's one of the reasons that tanning beds are so very dangerous, is because they're predominantly UVA radiation, so you won't burn, but you also get this really big hit of UVA radiation to your skin cells, leading to aging and cancer. So That's and they I know that they've tried working on UVA measures, and we just aren't there yet. With sunscreens, the mineral-based sunscreens, which a caller brought up earlier, those do a good job of blocking both UVA and UVB. When it comes to the chemical-based sunscreens, some do a good job at one spectrum, others might do a better job at another spectrum, and often when you're using a chemical-based sunscreen, you'll have a small handful of chemicals in there, one to help stabilize those chemicals, and two to help kind of fill in the gaps.
What, how high, I mean, there are SPF of above 50. Mm-hmm. Do they actually provide better or longer lasting protection?
Not really. And I just saw that there's something was passed by the FDA that they're going to block anything over 50. So in the future, we won't be able to see sunscreen companies market SPF 100 or 75 even. I think that's actually a good move, because what those higher numbers do is tend to give people a false sense of security. Because whether or not the sunscreen could potentially give you extra protection at hour 4, it's already worn off. Our skin cells are sloughing off all the time, and the sunscreen will go with it. And so even if you're using an SPF of 75 or an SPF of 100, you still need to reapply it every 2 hours. And so that's why I see a minimum of SPF of 30. And if you want to go higher, you can, but you still have to reapply it.
Louise in Dodgeville, it's your turn. Hi, Louise.
Hi. I have a question about the little kind of red broken blood vessels that you get like around your nose, your cheeks, sometimes on your chin, and the best way to treat those.
Mm-hmm. Well, those can be a couple of causes. Rosacea is a common condition that can cause permanently dilated blood vessels or blood vessels that are enlarged on the face, especially that central face area, like the middle of the cheeks, the nose, and the chin. So that would be one thing to kind of flush out. The other major cause of facial redness is sun exposure. And over a period of time with a lot of sun damage, that sun breaks down collagen, which helps support the skin, but it also helps support those little blood vessels. And those little blood vessels get much more prone to staying dilated or staying more wide open and being visible. There aren't any real great topical creams that can address this effectively long term. And most of the time you'd be looking at covering up. So makeup type cover-ups can be useful, or looking at a light-based treatment or laser treatment.
Louise, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Stan emailed us and wonders if you could talk about a rare skin problem he just read about minutes ago in a Yahoo Medical News report. It's a rare condition called acquired hypertrichosis lanugosa, I believe, HLA, which is the appearance of a whitish hair that grows in some areas that shouldn't have any hair. Stan has one coming out the front of his nose.
Okay. Well, so I think that those are probably two different things. If he has one hair that's growing out from the tip of his nose, that's just one active hair follicle. But I think what that condition is talking about is when people get sort of this velvety appearance of these fine, basically baby hairs. And we have hair follicles all over our body. And except for the palms and soles, we potentially, you know, some people will grow hair on their toes and some people will grow it on their nose. Some people grow it on their face more readily than others. But if it's the one kind of coarse white hair that might be growing off from the nose, that would be something that you could easily pluck if that's bothersome to you. But we can, you know, there's a couple conditions where we can see increased vellus hairs, and those are the hairs that we get on the arms that are not full terminal hairs. They tend to be more fine, and that's something that is kind of a development to help protect the body. And I'm not familiar with that specific. There's probably a genetic mutation in that specific condition, but it is very uncommon and not something that I've ever seen in my career.
Okay, so not very common at all. I'm wondering about the spray-on sunscreen versus the mm-hmm. lotion version. Now, frankly, I use that spray-on. I spray it on my hand mm-hmm. and then apply it. And then there's the lotion version. Is there any advantage to one or over the other? I use the one spray-on because it fits in my golf bag.
Yeah, and it's convenient. The spray-on sunscreens are convenient. And I think it is important to remember that UV radiation, we know, causes skin cancer. And we need to sort of take everything into account. So somebody who is fair and at risk for burning frequently, you know, that we sort of would want to take that into account. The sunscreen that you use is the one that's going to be the most effective. If, you know, we're really looking carefully at them, there are some problems with the spray-on sunscreens. And, you know, I had young kids at one point, and sometimes that's all you could do is just sort of spray them as they ran by, and you're getting at least a little bit on there. But the way that you're applying it is probably the best way to try to make sure that you're getting even layer, because if we're spraying it on, most of the sunscreen is going off into the environment, which those sunscreen chemicals are not great for the environment. One of the more recent things that's come under fire around the spray-on sunscreens is that many of them contain benzene, which is a potential carcinogen, and also difficult, you know, bad actor when it comes to the environment. The other thing that you can see with spray-on sunscreens, especially if people are spraying their face, is that you could inhale these chemicals. So rather than just having them sit on the skin and dealing with what potentially could be absorbed through the skin, if we're inhaling it, they're going to have a real different impact on our biology.
Yeah. You're scaring me.
Well, I'm a big fan of nighttime golfing. I think we should have more lit golf courses and or evening. It doesn't have to be the nighttime. But if you are fair skin, prone to sunburns, then maybe looking at not golfing in the middle of the day, wearing some of those protective clothing, and then using sunscreen, kind of as I mentioned earlier, as that backup plan, or for parts of the body that you can't cover up, is going to be more beneficial.
How much does getting a sunburn increase your risk of premature aging, aging?
Yeah, dramatically. It also depends a little bit on your skin type, but UV radiation will dramatically accelerate that. And there are some great pictures online of truck drivers that, you know, or there's one of a secretary where she sat at a window and she got the UV radiation through the window, and the other half of her face is completely not aged at all because she didn't have a life, I guess, outside of her secretarial work. Or in the instance of the truck driver, you see this dramatic difference in photo aging, and that gives us a real sense of what the sun can do in terms of our aging process. About 90% or possibly even more of what we consider aging is really photo aging. So, you know, that really is accumulation of sun exposure over time. So even just five peeling sunburns in childhood can double your risk of melanoma, which is a deadly form of skin cancer that is definitely increasing in incidence. We're seeing a lot more of melanoma now than we used to. And so, you know, those sunburns are, and it usually takes many years to see the downstream effects from that early onset DNA damage. So, you know, it's really important to try to avoid burns as best as you can. And for somebody that's got a little more pigment in their skin, they could maybe tolerate a little more sun exposure than somebody who has almost no pigment like me, I'll burn if I look outside on a sunny day.
You do have a fair skin, for sure.
Yeah.
Is that what got you into this whole business?
Actually, no. I think I did have some bad burns as a kid. I had sun poisoning when I was about 12. And, you know, as I lay in Florida and my family was all enjoying the beach, I thought, oh, this is just not for me. So that was long before I made the decision to become a dermatologist.
Well, Dr. Apple Bodimer, thank you so much for spending time with us today. I really appreciate it. And I hope you'll come back and be with us again. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. And thank you, callers, for all of your questions.
Dr. Apple Bodimer, a dermatologist and professor in the Department of Dermatology at UW-Madison. Coming up, we're going to have a little visit with author Mo Rocca. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News and The Larry Mueller Show.
Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth to be young at heart.
For as rich as you are, it's much better by far
to be young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you derive out of being alive.
And here is the best part.
You'll have a head start
if you are among the very young at heart.
Dick Van Dyke and his wife Arlene singing Young at Heart. That was recorded 6 years ago when Dick Van Dyke was 92 years old, and he's still going strong today. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on WPR News. Talking today about people who did amazing things in their later years. And back with us, Mo Rocca. He is, oh boy, you know him. He's correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning, host of the hit Mobituaries podcast, host of the Henry Ford's Innovation Nation, also a frequent panelist on NPR's weekly quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, host and creator of cooking channels, My Grandmother's Ravioli. We talked to him a few years back about his New York Times bestselling book, Mobituaries, Great Lives Worth Reliving. And his new book is Roctogenarians, Late in Life Debuts, Comebacks, and Triumphs. He wrote it with co-author Jonathan Greenberg. So, what about you? Are you living life to its fullest as you age? What's your secret? I hope you'll be part of the conversation. Number to call is 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Mo Rocca, welcome back. Great to have you back on the show.
Larry, it is great to be with you. And three things. Number one, great to be with you. Number two, I love callers. And number three, it's not for me to correct you, but I think we should say that Dick Van Dyke was just 92 when he recorded that song.
Just 92. You're right about that. Well, listen, another great book. I love the book. I tell you what I did. I sat on my porch on a sunny afternoon, and my flowers on the front porch, right in front, are all in bloom. And I had a glorious several hours reading your book. It's another great book and another great title. And I was thinking about your titles. One I didn't mention was your book, All the President Pets, the story of one reporter who refused to roll over, which I had me laughing even before, opening the book. Do you come up with those titles or does somebody else?
You know, I think I've come up with all of those titles, I guess. and first of all, if you did read All the President's Pets, I thank you and the other 24 people who actually read it. It was an early endeavor, but I stand by it. I'm very proud of it. It was a historical novel, a thriller. It was a cross between All the President's Men, The Da Vinci Code, and Charlotte's Web. And it was a thriller using all real presidential pets. I'm a big history buff. And these were all the pets who have lived in the White House from the beginning. And they were conspiring to make decisions for the executive branch. And I'll let you decide if that's a good thing or a bad thing. It depends, I suppose. Roctogenarians, it's funny. I will tell you that Simon & Schuster, who published this book, an editor there had first suggested Moroctogenarians. And while I am not above, forgive my language, pimping out my name for a book title, I thought that was a little bit of a mouthful. So I thought Roctogenarians is a little bit more manageable.
Oh, man. You know, you wrote in your introduction that at the age of 46, you had begun to think about your life, and maybe is your life going downhill with not many opportunities left? I'm sure you're not alone in that thinking. Why do you think we do that to ourselves?
You know, I think it's more powerful and insidious than we realize. This idea that you hit a certain age and it's all doors closing, exit ramps being shut off, diminishing opportunities. The culture sort of sends that message. And indeed, yeah, I start the book by talking about when I was on the panel for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and we had Chance the Rapper on. He was very, very hot. He had just come on the scene, and I think it was 2015. And I asked him this jokey question. I said, I'm 46. Is it too late for me to become a rapper? And people laughed because it was kind of an easy laugh. And, you know, but he looked at me without skipping a beat. He said, quite seriously, he said, I don't know. Some people might say it's too soon. And that got a laugh too. The conversation went on, but I was really struck by his response because I think there was truth underneath what he was saying, which is that, you know, as you get older, you have more to say and you have more to contribute. And I had fallen into the trap, even though I was just making a joke with that question, I think I had fallen into the trap of thinking of myself as over the hill at 46. And I'm embarrassed to admit that. And so I kind of had to readjust my own thinking and say, this is crazy. I mean, 46 is young. And, you know, John and I in this book wanted to present, I guess, a counterpoint to ageism, which is real, which is really stupid. Ageism is a real thing. And so we collected these stories of people in their 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, even their 100s, you know, doing remarkable things.
It is just was a fascinating read for me. I really, really enjoyed learning about all of the people in the book. I was taking notes as I went along, and I got through my list of names that I was going to talk to you about, and I thought, we'll never get to all of this. There were at least 20 names, and there are a lot more than that in the book. So what do you think, is there something that they all have in common, these people that you profile in the book? Is it something we're born with, or maybe in that case it might be true, or can we all cultivate it?
We can all cultivate it. There are a few patterns here. The most obvious being that none of them accepted the idea that the last third of life is a time for winding things down, for wrapping things up. They just didn't think that way. And they are very much in it, present-minded. They're certainly not fixated on the past, but this is a surprise to me. I always assumed that as you get older, you start fretting more about the time you have left. Sort of the opposite happened, certainly with these people. They weren't fretting. They were very much in it, present-minded, whether it was because, like Colonel Sanders, they needed to be because their business had fallen apart and he at age 66, you know, only had Social Security, $105 a month, and realized that he needed to do something, you know, if he was going to survive and thrive. He got in a car with two pressure cookers and a bucket of his secret recipe of 11 herbs and spices, and he drove town to town cooking for people. This is at age 66, and within 8 years, he was the face of a Kentucky Fried empire with 800 outlets worldwide. And I love that image of him driving down the road, right? Because he's just moving forward. He just acts, he just does. Another pattern that we found in these stories is that, and this is something I learned when I did my cooking show, when I cooked with grandmothers and grandfathers in their kitchens across the country, is that the older these people get, and I think this is generally true, the less they care about what other people think of them. And I think that's where we all want to be, right? And so these are people who are not crowdsourcing their decisions, crowdsourcing who they are, which is, I think, what a lot of young people do, especially with social media. They know who they are. They're unfettered. And so it's and I think that's true of older people in general, that they tend to care less about what other people think of them. So it's no great coincidence that they end up acting and doing rather than dithering and worrying. Another pattern, and I know I'm throwing these all at you here, Larry, I hope it's okay, is there is in many cases kind of a return to childhood. And I think the story of Matisse is a great example of this. You know, Matisse was already hailed as a great modernist by the time he was in his early 70s, hailed well before then. But in his 70s, cancer robbed him of the ability to paint. He couldn't sit upright any longer. But instead of just sort of playing a highlights reel of his greatest hits in his mind and just welcoming flatterers into his home to tell him how great he was, he traded in his paintbrush for a giant pair of scissors and began doing these paper cutouts, which themselves comprised this great epoch of his career. But he himself talked about how he was fascinated by the big shapes, the bold colors of these paper cutouts, and that for him, it lacked complication. It was a return to childhood in a second life. So childlike rather than childish. And so we see that in a lot of these stories, sometimes in very literal ways, like Laura Ingalls Wilder and Frank McCourt, both writing about their childhoods and being published for the first time in their mid to late 60s. Or somebody like, you know, Brian May, the great guitarist for the rock band Queen, returning to an early endeavor. And we call this section of the book Unfinished Business. He had been studying astrophysics when he became a Hall of Fame rock and roll guitarist. And so at the age of 60, he returned to his studies and earned his PhD. Yeah. So there are a number of patterns throughout.
James in Pewaukee has something for us. Let's go to James. Thank you for calling, James.
Hello. I just wanted to say I had listened to Mo Rocca's book, Mobituaries, while I was on a cross-country drive. And having the author do the reading of the book was just fantastic. And it was a great way to spend the time driving and listening to those stories, which I was fascinated by each and every one of them. So I wanted to thank him for his efforts, and I'm definitely going to look after his new book and maybe listen to that on the road too.
James.
Wow, that is awfully nice, James. Thank you. And Larry, let me tell you, this is just why I love talking to Wisconsin. And I have to tell you, by the way, I just want to wedge in here right now that I made, and I'm a little embarrassed about this, my very first trip to Madison last summer. I had been all over this country, and I always thought, why have I not made it to Madison? And my partner and I went to Madison, and we spent 4th of July there on a motorboat in Lake Monona. And I cannot tell you, seeing the fireworks from a little motorboat in the, you know, and thanks so much to Shelley and Matt for taking us out. I mean, to see the fireworks over the state capitol in Madison, to me, I was like, you cannot top this for a July 4th celebration. I just wanted to put that out there.
Oh, it is a wonderful place to be, and for sure. Eddie from Cedarburg couldn't stay with us, but he's wondering if having a good sex life can prolong your life.
Well, I think, yes, I'm trying to think of people in the book who have had great sex lives. We should have included a section on that. Colonel Sanders, I bet he had a pretty good sex life, especially, yeah, because I mean, he looked great in that white suit. And he did say a man will in a congressional hearing once said a man will rust out sooner than he'll wear out. So maybe he was cooking until late into his 80s. So that's for sure. Clara Peller's also, and she did ask that question, where's the beef, which could be interpreted differently, I suppose. So, yeah.
Claire, tell us, I loved hearing about Colonel Sanders first, and then you had Clara Peller. Tell us about her. Talk about her with this where's the beef. I remember those ads well.
Okay, well, so Clara Peller is a little bit more of a kind of it could happen to you story. So it's a little bit of a fantasy, but in her case, it was real. So Clara Peller, first of all, I love the fact that on Clara Peller's Wikipedia entry, her birthplace is listed as Imperial Russia. I mean, that old. And she was a manicurist in Chicago with this great throaty voice. And, you know, 1984 was a really big year for women under 4 feet, 11 inches tall. We had Mary Lou Retton at the Olympics, and then we had Clara Peller asking, where's the beef? Now, one of the great things about her, when she did that Wendy's ad, she came in, it was three of the women there. And her line was actually scripted as, where's all the beef? But because of her emphysema, she could not get all four words out. And what a happy accident is where's all the beef would never have become a meme, would never have become iconic. she could only get out, "Where's the beef?" And it just, of course, made her a household name. She ended up on all these talk shows and all that. Then she went and she did a Prego spaghetti sauce ad, and she kind of messed things up because the Wendy's people got upset at her for asking, for saying, "I found the beef and I found it in Prego tomato sauce." But that does not tarnish the memory of Clara Peller. I will say, I always wondered what happened to the other two ladies in the ad. If they thought I could be the breakout star, and Clara ended up being sort of the Beyonce of that ad. But you know, I hope that they enjoyed the ride they had with her.
Tom in Madison will give you a chance. Hi, Tom.
Hey, thanks for having me aboard. I think it's a great bunch of stories. I'm definitely somebody who started life over at 50. I've been a folk singer my whole life, and all of a sudden I moved to Madison, Wisconsin. I started working with younger people, older people than myself, and I'm doing more theater than I've ever done. I've even appeared in a couple of operas, which I never thought would happen. I started tap dancing at 60. And I've got a one-man show that I'm going to take on the road at the age of 67.
Oh,
fantastic. That is that. Well, you know, we have a whole section on actors, and I love Matt. That story is so inspiring. You know, Estelle Getty, we you can't write a book like this and not include at least one Golden Girl. I think, like, the book would have, we would have been arrested if you put out a book like this and not include one of those four. And Estelle Getty made her national television debut at 62. I mean, she'd spent her life, she was married at 23, raised her two sons, but she took every little tiny role she could. By the time she was in her 50s, she said she was only playing mothers, Jewish mothers, Italian mothers, Irish mothers. She said she played everyone's mother except Attila the Hun. But she held on to that dream, and she made it happen when she was in her 60s. And that was one of the, I think, Sophia on The Golden Girls is one of the funniest characters on a sitcom in the last 40 years. So it really can happen.
Tom, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your story very much. What about your story? Give us a call with your story, or maybe you just have a question or a comment. Number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller with Mo Rocca, and you are listening to WPR News. Talking with Mo Rocca, who is the author, along with Jonathan Greenberg, of the book Roctogenarians, Late in Life Debuts, Comebacks, and Triumphs. Having a great time talking with him. What about you? Have you or someone you know lived their best life in later years? What do you think keeps people productive? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. You know, you profiled some legends. Rena Moreno, you mentioned Estelle Getty. Morgan Freeman was interesting to me because he, and you note this, he made his age into an asset, which is something that not everybody has been able to do, I think.
Yeah, absolutely right. He really sort of grew into his roles. But, you know, one of the reasons we really wanted to, there were two additional reasons we wanted to tell the story of Morgan Freeman. Number one, he, and I knew this from profiling Rita Moreno years ago for CBS Sunday Morning, and then I re-interviewed her for the book. Their lives sort of intertwine. Rita Moreno early on was a star. She won the Oscar for West Side Story. Then in her 40s, she was married with a daughter. She moved to New York, and she took this role on the show Electric Company, which for me was formative. It's my earliest TV memory is Rita Moreno going, "Hey, you guys." And I loved it. I mean, with all due respect to Sesame Street, that was a slow lane. I was an Electric Company person. Morgan Freeman was also on the Electric Company, but to that point was really unknown. And it turned out he was really frustrated because he felt that he wasn't able to show his full range of talent. And so, and Rita Moreno herself, she said, didn't recognize how talented this man was. Afterwards, his career really took off, and he got his first Oscar nomination after, you know, I believe it was when he was 52, and then won one finally in his 60s. But he had really chopped it out early on. He said, you know, when asked about the struggles of an older actor, he said, I don't know anything about the struggles of an older actor. I know about the struggles of a younger actor. And part of it was because of his great integrity. He once walked out of an audition for a TV commercial because there was a part labeled The Jew. He quit another role because there was a stereotypical treatment, an offensive, he felt, treatment of a Native American character. So he really was a person of very high morals. And, you know, he didn't take the easy route. And he was ultimately rewarded for it. And thank goodness, because he's obviously such a wonderful actor.
And he and Rita Moreno were very close, have been very close friends.
They both presented SAG Lifetime Achievement Awards to each other. So it's really a great story of kind of different paths, but both of them have really blossomed. Him sort of for the first time, her again in their older years.
Yeah. You also write, and you don't hear many stories about protégés who are still going strong into their 90s. Ruth Slenczynska?
So this is a wonderful story. Ruth Slenczynska, she's now 99. I profiled her for CBS Sunday Morning when she was 97. She had an album out. She's a virtuoso pianist, classical pianist. She had been very famous very early in life. She was known as the Shirley Temple of classical music. She toured Europe when she was 4 and 5 years old. At the age of 9, she subbed for Rachmaninoff, like actually Rachmaninoff. They were friends, and he had to miss a concert date when she was 9 years old, and she filled in for him. Her father was abusive, tormented her. He was a frustrated violinist who had been injured in World War I, took out his frustration on her, did not rob her completely of her childhood, literally did not allow her to play with dolls. He would chase her around the apartment with a stick when she wasn't practicing. She would hear her sisters playing on the street below, but was not allowed to join them. So understandably, she quit when she was a teenager. She had to return to the piano later just to make a living by playing and then by teaching. But then she, in later years, learned to love the piano on her own terms. So it's ultimately, she and the piano are a great, complicated love story. But when I met her in her late 90s, she said to me, listen, you don't really learn to play until you're in your 60s. The notes may be the same, but the story you're telling is different. And I just thought this was a wonderful story of somebody returning to their childhood, but in a much happier way. And today she lives with a former student of hers and that woman's husband. They help take care of her, though she's still in very good shape at 99. But they were telling me that they taught her how to carve a jack-o'-lantern. She'd never done that. You know, they take her at Christmas time to look at the lights on different trees and front yards, that essentially they're giving her, helping to give her the childhood she never had. So it's a beautiful, wonderful story, I think, of somebody really kind of growing and at their happiest in their 90s.
You know, and others of the people that you profile had difficult childhoods. Why do some, how are some people able to get past that?
You know, I suppose some of it is just dispositional, that they are capable of not fixating on the past. I mean, I think all of these people are ultimately optimists. You know, there's a section on widows, and there are three stories, very different. The first two, though, are of women who, look, and this is a little bit controversial, Larry, and let me just preface this by saying that I've met a lot of older women in my time. Look, old people are my jam. I just love interviewing older people much more so than younger people. And I've met a lot of older women who love their husbands and will be very sad when their husbands die, but are also going to be kind of relieved. Let's just face it. Okay. And so two of these stories are about women who, because of the times they grew up in, had a lot more freedom once they were widowed. In both cases, actually legally. Madame Clicquot, who is the person behind Veuve Clicquot, which the champagne literally means the widow Clicquot, you never remarried after her husband died, because in 19th century France, she actually had a lot more rights as a widow than she had as a married woman. And the same with English woman Mary Delaney in 18th century England, who ended up becoming a master of decoupage, and whose works of art, you know, combine artistry, great artistry, decoupage, and botany, and created these beautiful, beautiful renderings of plant life. She too had a miserable first marriage, a happier second marriage. But after she was widowed the second time, she never remarried, because she was really able to have more freedom and devote herself to her craft. So I think those are people for whom happiness came later.
Yeah. And Mary Delaney, I've interviewed, I can remember interviewing a botanist on the show, and talked with great reverence about Mary Delaney.
And they're beautiful, the works of art.
Beautiful, beautiful works of art. Well, Bob in Menominee wonders, or wanted to bring up Satchel Paige, a baseball player who joined the Cleveland Indians at age 42 and helped the team win the World Series title. And he was quoted as saying, "Age is a question of mind over matter. If you don't mind, it don't matter."
Well, Satchel Paige, who was in the obituaries book, and I hope I get this right, forgive me, I don't have it in front of me, but I believe Satchel Paige pitched a game at 57. I mean, he was still pitching at 57. So it's, I mean, what a remarkable example. And if you ever get a chance, I think on YouTube, you can see him. Is it on Dick Cavett? But it's a great interview.
You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you as we talk with Mo Rocca about his book, Roctogenarians, Late-in-Life Debuts, Comebacks, and Triumphs. Great to have him with us. We can't not talk about Laura Ingalls Wilder, the Little House on the Prairie book. She spent part of her girlhood here in Wisconsin, but her life much more difficult than what we saw in the TV series, for sure.
Yeah, you know, I was unaware of that before this project, that, and I loved the books, those 8 books, and the TV series, which is very different, but I loved them both. But I didn't realize that her life was so difficult after those early years, that she and his name apparently was really pronounced Al Manzo on the TV show, was Almanzo, which I think is more pleasing to the ear. But she and Al Manzo went from state to state, sometimes being chased by creditors. They finally ended up in the Ozarks of Missouri. Their daughter, Rose, had to go to school without shoes. I mean, they were that poor. Laura began writing for a journal, an agricultural journal called the Missouri Ruralist, and writing a domestic life column, basically. But the stock market crash and the depression hit them so hard that she ultimately had to turn to writing basically for survival. And her daughter, Rose, who is today somewhat of a controversial figure, really does deserve credit for saying to her mother, "Listen, you grew up at an epic time in American history, the closing of the frontier in 1890. You need to write your story, and write as if you're writing in a diary, as if you're just writing for yourself." And it's hard to think of better advice to give a novice writer. And so she did write. She first wrote what was more kind of a warts and all memoir, and it didn't work. But it was an editor who advised her to write for children instead, to frame it more as a children's book. And, you know, anthologies, serials were not a common thing then at the time in the 1930s for targeting children. So it was really rather new. In any case, she was 65 when the first of these books were published. And of course, her life changed. And, you know, that advice to write as if you're writing in a diary is so powerful. And I think is a good reason why those books, you know, are compelling to people worldwide. My mother is an immigrant from Colombia, and growing up, she loved that TV show and she loved those books. I mean, they and apparently they're especially big in East Asia, those stories. So a great inspiring story.
Did you find that people who find success later in life deal with fame better?
You know, I haven't been asked that, and I think they do. And, you know, it's funny, I'm thinking, I saw my friend Steve Carell the other day. We were on The Daily Show together now, gosh, 25 years ago. And, you know, I wouldn't say that Steve's well-deserved success came late, but I have thought that he was in his 40s, as opposed to, you know, some of these Hollywood stars who become big in their 20s. And it's hard to think of somebody who's more solid, who's a superstar, and not that I know that many, but he's somebody who is so solid and balanced. And I think probably a factor in that is that he really kind of hit it big on the later end. Yeah, so I would say so. And I think that that's borne out by the stories in this book, that there's a kind of stability. I'll tell you also, there's a section of the book called It's About Time. It's a little bit different than the other sections of the book, and it profiles people who received recognition very late in life, sort of the anti-Van Gogh, who kind of died largely unrecognized in his 30s. But all these people, animator Tyrus Wong, responsible for the look of Bambi, Carmen Herrera, the abstract expressionist, who had her first solo show at a major museum when she was 101 and still painting. She lived until and kept painting until the end at 106. And John Goodenough, who's the oldest Nobel laureate, the co-inventor of the lithium-ion battery, who was honored with the Nobel at 97. All three, one thing in common, they all had extraordinarily long marriages. They had marriages of 58, 60, and 61 years, respectively. And they all credited their spouse with seeing them through the long periods in which no one recognized what they were doing. And so I think that's a very important pattern to point out.
I wanted to also bring up another person. You've got a section called readers. And
yeah.
Mary Hardaway Walker was one that came to mind who, I think she was who learned to read very late in life. I think she was 110 or something.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I believe it's a 21% of American adults are functionally illiterate, which is so terrible. It's such a heartbreak. And so we collected a number of those stories, including one that my colleague Steve Hartman on CBS Sunday Morning had profiled, a man named Ed Bray, who was a recipient of the Bronze Star, who had been at Normandy, you know, had served his country so valiantly, selflessly, didn't know how to read, and was able to get by while his wife was alive. And then when she died, he no longer had her to kind of lean on for that. And so at the age of 89, he finally got together. His story was publicized. He said, before I die, want to read one book, even if it's about Mickey Mouse, he said. And then he's from Oklahoma. And then it was a someone in Oklahoma, an educator, who heard the story, volunteered her time. And he did indeed end up learning how to read. His first book was not about Mickey Mouse. It was about George Washington. And he died at 100 not long ago. And he's in the Oklahoma Centenarians Hall of Fame. But it was such a moving story. And so we have a section on the writers who broke out late, Frank McCourt, Laura Ingalls Wilder, and Peter Mark Roget of Roget's Thesaurus, published when he was 73. But we followed it up indeed with a section on readers, people who learned to read late in life.
Mo Rocca, our guest today, he is the co-author of Roctogenarians, Late in Life Debuts, Comebacks, and Triumphs. Join in with your questions. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk with Mo Rocca about his book, Roctogenarians, Late in Life Debuts, Comebacks, and Triumphs. And again, join in 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. You mentioned Frank McCourt a couple of times, and we really didn't go into his story, which I thought was a really interesting one because he didn't think he had a story to tell. And then comes Angela's Ashes, the great book.
You know, the story of Frank McCourt may be my favorite in the book. I find it so moving that Frank McCourt spent his life, much of his life, most of his life, struggling with whether his story was even worth telling. He was ashamed of the poverty he grew up in Limerick, Ireland. But he would tell these stories as a high school English teacher in New York City. And he told stories about his childhood, in part to kind of connect with his students and keep them focused, right? So almost as a reward, as a way of both treating them, but also just keeping them in the tent. And then the kids said, you know, you got to write a book. And Frank McCourt was also friends with some established writers in New York who also told him the same thing. But he couldn't bring himself to do it. Ultimately, he decided, in his own words, that he would die howling if he didn't get his story out. And so he wrote Angela's Ashes, and it was published when he was 66 and became a global sensation. And he later said, it took me 2 years and all of my life to tell my story. And it's so moving, and interviews with him, you know, even though he's been gone for a while, I mean, still sparkle. It's hard to believe he's not alive because he's so alive when you watch tape of him. But, you know, I think a lot of people struggle with whether their stories are worth telling. And on the other side, you know, there you can tell it. And if you don't, it's just so heartbreaking to contemplate that. I mean, what we would have been denied had Frank McCourt not told his story, but also just the thought of someone going to their grave thinking their story isn't worth telling. And I include a chapter, the final chapter is about my own mother, who I mentioned is an immigrant from Colombia, who is a very, very private person. And twice during the course of writing this book, she came to me and she said, are you going to write about me? And the first time I thought she was kidding, the first time she asked. When she asked a second time, I knew she was serious. And I did that thing that I know we all know we're supposed to do, but don't do for whatever reason in most of the time, which is I sat down and I basically interviewed her and I asked her questions, and it filled in a lot of blanks. So the final chapter is about her. But as I say in the book, I'm really grateful to her for letting me do it, really for asking me to do it. But I'm more than that, I'm just relieved and happy that she acknowledged at her late age, I can't tell you how old she is, she'd kill me, but I can tell you that she's 4 years shy of a big birthday with three digits. But I'm just relieved that she realizes at this late stage that her story is worth telling.
That's a very moving chapter in the book, by the way, and I really enjoyed reading it. Well, I enjoyed every story. Almost every one was a revelation.
What about Mr. Pickles? What about Mr. Pickles, the Houston Zoo tortoise?
Yeah, Mr. Pickles. Now, there's a quote-unquote guy who had, when you're talking about sex.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I'm embarrassed that when we talked about sex earlier in this hour that I didn't bring him up. Mr. Pickles, the Houston Zoo tortoise, of course, it became a first-time father at the age of 90. And Larry, you were impressed by Al Pacino, who really was just a kid at 83. But Mr. Pickles, you know, we didn't know what was going on, why he didn't have kids. But he got together with, I would say, Mrs. Pickles, but I have no idea what their arrangement is. And she was 53. And he had three beautiful radiated tortoise babies. Named Dill, Gherkin, and Jalapeno. And, you know, his subspecies of tortoise you know, they generally live till 150. So, I mean, he could have a lot more kids. He could end up becoming the Nick Cannon of tortoises.
Oh my goodness me! There are a couple sections on. Well, there was a story about Mr. Pickles, but you did have a section on horses well, which I thought interesting. But before I ask you about that, I want to go make sure we talk about the leaders of the civil rights movement, because I think most of the time we think of them as fairly young people. But that certainly wasn't the case with Mary Church Terrell.
Yeah. So, you know, John Lewis was 25 when he led marches across Edmund Pettus Bridge. Martin Luther King, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was 34 when he delivered the I Have a Dream speech. And I don't think I'm alone when I think of the civil rights era, of thinking of the young heroes. But we did not know before we looked into it the story of Mary Church Terrell. I know that there were older leaders. Who were these people? Mary Church Terrell had already lived a heroic, very distinguished life. She was born a few months after the Emancipation Proclamation. She was an early leader in the fight against the brutal practice of lynching as a young woman. She accompanied a much older Frederick Douglass to the White House to petition President Benjamin Harrison to come out more strongly against lynching. As a middle-aged woman, she was a co-founder of the NAACP. But it was at the age of 86, when she had more than earned her rest, that she began leading sit-ins at segregated Washington, D.C. lunch counters, because to the special shame of this country, you know, the nation's capital, the Citadel of Liberty, was actually segregated from the time President Woodrow Wilson. He had sort of resegregated the federal government and public accommodation sort of followed suit. And so she became sort of the face, more than the face. She was actually leading these sit-ins for what ultimately were successful demonstrations that culminated in the desegregation of the nation's capital. But she was doing this at the age of 86. So it was really a remarkable story. What I find particularly powerful about it are public servants who are fighting for a world that at best they will enjoy for a couple of years. Yeah. Mary Church Terrell, she wasn't going to live until 130. She was doing this not for herself, right? She was doing this for her literal and figurative children and children's children. And it's very, very powerful.
I think purpose. I wonder how important is purpose for people contributing in their later years?
Gee whiz, you know, that is such a great point, because, you know, I think it's sort of the opposite of that, of what I think. When people don't have purpose, and it's no wonder that so many people unfortunately do languish in old age. And Mary Church Terrell is a great example of somebody who felt needed and was needed. Yeah, I think it's a huge motivator. I think that there are a lot of people, Larry. I don't mean to knock on lawyers here, but in my anecdotal experience, it happens a lot with lawyers, people who say, I'm eventually going to make a move and I'm going to get back, or I'm going to finally commit myself to this cause that I believe in, but have never had time to really devote myself to. Something keeps them from doing it. And I think it's harsh and cynical and lazy to say greed. I think maybe that's in some cases, but I think it's fear. And the people in this book who overcame that fear, I mean, they didn't look back. And I think they're so much happier because they did. There's a section of architects, because architects, and this has been pointed out by many other people, so many architects, world-class architects, peak in their last years. It's really remarkably inspiring. But we included Ian Pei and Frank Lloyd Wright, who had their capstones, if you will, in their last decades, their architectural capstones. But we also included Yasmin Lahri, Pakistan's first professional woman architect, because she had been a star architect. She had done these beautiful, glitzy, glamorous, corporate commissions that were, were in magazines all over the world. But with the devastating earthquake in Kashmir in 2005 that killed 80,000 people and left 500,000 families homeless, she finally made the move. She was 64 and she said, I'm done. I'm done with corporate commissions. I want to build sustainable housing. And she'd already had experience in helping to preserve UNESCO heritage sites and was experienced in some traditional materials and methods. But she took that know-how and she just made a clean break. And she turned away from corporate commissions and has now spent the last two decades helping to house tens of thousands of poor Pakistanis. And she's happier than she's ever been.
Yeah. That was a great story. Another story that really caught my attention was the invention of the OXO brand.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one of the other things that people in the book, a pattern that really jumps out, it jumped out at us at least, is that people who excel late in life look at endings as beginnings. Because physical limitations, we're not sugarcoating things here. Physical limitations are an inevitability, unless you're a horse, and then there's some horses that really, really thrive much later. But or you're Mr. Pickles and really come into your own ninth, but so to speak. The Farber, Sam and Betsy Farber, were a couple who were well off and were all set for retirement. And they were in the south of France. They had done well for themselves. But Betsy was trying to use a peeler to make an apple tart. And her arthritis was making it very, very difficult. And it was then that they decided to collaborate with another specialist and create a peeler that someone with arthritis could use. And this was the germ of the OXO Good Grips and what became an empire. And I use that peeler. I love it. But and they weren't creating something, a specialty item, which already existed for people with arthritis. They became pioneers in what's known as universal design. But this really came from Betsy's limitation. And again, this idea of looking at endings as beginnings, being resourceful. Borges is the same way, the Argentinian Nobel laureate. He had written short stories for the bulk of his career, but when he became blind in his 50s and 60s, he didn't stop writing. He found a new pathway. And his blindness, he came to view as a blessing because he began composing verse, poetry. He said it was something that he could do without eyesight. He could walk around, he could compose it in his head. And so it opened up a whole other wellspring for him.
Boy, I'm telling you, we have talked about a few of the people in your book, but we definitely haven't covered them all. And this has been so much fun for me, Mo. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today and talk about your book. It was a wonderful pleasure. You have a wonderful book, and I hope we get a chance to talk again. Thank you so much.
Well, Larry, I love talking to you, and I hope people discover it. And the audiobook is narrated by me, if you haven't gotten sick of my voice already.
Jill Nadeau loved the audiobook. And so, she absolutely loved it. Mo Rocca,
thanks, Jill.
Okay. Our guest, his book with Jonathan Greenberg is titled Roctogenarians, Late in Life Debuts, Comebacks, and Triumphs. We haven't covered anywhere close to all of what's in the book. Believe me, you should take a look. And I want to thank you for joining us today. It's a team effort here. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud, technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening. And stay with us. Lots in store.